Well, so it's kind of the perfect companion piece for our discussion with Nicholas Meyer, which I'll be floating on, I think, to like Tuesday. Did I geek out enough, do you think? The new book is fun. It's interesting. Your Flying Car Awaits: Robot Butlers, Lunar Vacations, and Other Dead Wrong Predictions of the 20th Century. This comes out at a time where there's another book that's on the market about how many sci-fi elements, how many, sci-fi inventions of movies past and TV shows past ended up being products that we use every day. But they didn't all come true. And these are some of the big ones that didn't. We'll talk about that and why next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Paul Milo is the author of Your Flying Car Awaits, Robot Butlers, Lunar Vacations, and Other Dead Wrong Predictions of the 20th Century. Thank you, Paul Milo, for agreeing to come on in our last hour here.
Thank you for having me, and good morning.
Oh, good morning. Now, I think I felt like writing this book like 10 years ago. I've been waiting for my flying car forever, for my jetpack, for all the things that we were told. We're not just going to be, around. They were going to be routine. They were going to be ubiquitous. And flying cars were, I mean, we saw them experimented with in like James Bond movies. And every time you'd see it, you'd go like, oh, good, it's coming. And then it never comes. So what's holding us back?
With the flying car specifically, and with a lot of the a lot of the predictions I talk about in my book, it's not the technology because as you just pointed out, there's some viable prototypes. There's some good prototypes that are being built. They can make flying cars work on the individual level, but when you're talking about a transportation system for a nation, for millions of people, that's where you run into roadblocks. Someone and actually more than one person, several people at the government level, in the private sector would have to get together and decide that we're going to get rid of our roads and replace them with sky highways and have everybody in flying cars. I mean, you'd need considerable infrastructure investment for one thing. I mean, you'd need to have something like air traffic controllers, thousands and thousands of more air traffic controllers for one thing. You'd need
Or you could have it like they have in the Star Trek movies, or sorry, Star Wars movies, where somehow there would be these built-in devices that would prevent us from being able to come too close to each other. And you wouldn't need somebody directing it, they would be self-directed.
And
That's what
maybe,
I was expecting. That kind of thing where you're always
all
being
right.
like almost like opposite magnets, where you're always prevented from bumping into each other.
Well, I didn't think of the magnet thing. My immediate thought was to the collision avoidance technology, which obviously is coming along. I mean, it's working on terrestrial cars, and I suppose, down the road, that might be in place for a flying car. The magnet thing is pretty interesting, though. I hadn't thought of that.
I just, but whether it's the flying cars or not, I mean, I think the point you immediately bring up is we just assumed that if we could build it, they would. And what we've learned about the difference between, say, the predictions from 30, 40 years ago and where we are today is there still has to be some sort of profit incentive, or there has to be a need for it, in a way that if we don't have it, we don't build it.
And sometimes, I mean, oftentimes it's a profit incentive. Oftentimes, it's a common sense incentive. Oftentimes, it's just serendipity. I mean, we just happen to get there. I mean, the internet as a technology, for instance, just kind of fell into place. They sort of kind of were working on something like an information web, but the internet that we wound up with, which is fantastic, obviously, which changed the world, really just kind of happened by happenstance almost. It naturally evolved. So sometimes it goes that way too. But your broader point's correct. I mean, there's often a vast gulf between what we could do and what we will do.
So again, we're talking with Paul Milo. The book is Your Flying Car Awaits. Very funny, by the way, and
Thank you.
a great mix of sci-fi and just kind of the hopes and dreams of many of us that all of these things were going to be at our disposal. And in a way, it would make us all superheroes. I mean, I think that's part of the sort of for a theme for me is a lot of these inventions put us on the par with gods and with a small g.
Right, absolutely. The medical technology stuff, and when I was putting that chapter together, I was very careful in my phrasing because, you know, every day we're kind of getting close to at least some of the things they envisioned 40 or 50 years ago, and we're kind of not. There was supposed to be, you know, the Bionic Man show, Bionic Woman show from the 70s. I loved that show when I was a kid. I envisioned that for right now. I thought I'd be able to jump over a building and things like that. You know, obviously we're not there yet, but at the same time, the advances in prosthetic technology are just amazing. And what's interesting and tragic too, but we've seen this time and time again, the advances in prosthetic technology as an aside often coincide with war for obvious reasons. There were a spate of predictions about advances in prosthetics and organ regeneration and things like that during the Vietnam War. And there was some work, you know, a lot of progress made. That's when a lot of predictions were made about, you know, our ability to regrow organs and to build artificial lungs and artificial eyes and all these things, because there were great doctors at Veterans Administration hospitals, but other places too, who were working on this. So that led to a spate of predictions about our ability to create bionic parts. And now here we are again in the midst of two wars. We have a lot of men and women coming back from overseas who are in need of help. And it's been this great boon to prosthetic technology. I mean, what they can do now is just astounding.
Well, and actually, to make the point then back to the internet, had it not been for the military, we wouldn't have had the internet. And it, again, there was a need, and somehow once at a certain point that sort of bled back over into society at large. But that's kind of the same thing I was hoping for out of being able to talk to dolphins, because I was an Aquaman fan, and I always thought it was cool that he could talk to, you know, whales and dolphins or whatever. But also, there was that great movie. Was it The Day of the Dolphin, where like a George C. Scott movie or something, where dolphins or porpoises end up being, you know, being able to communicate with them because of a military purpose. And I think, well, we should have had that one. I mean, that by now we should be able to talk to dolphins. I don't know why we can't talk to dolphins. It seemed like there'd be enough of a cause, enough of a reason, enough research. People have been working on that one for decades. How come we can't talk to dolphins?
I don't know, but I think the reason why a lot of people thought, well there's twin reasons, really. One was that, you know, this is old hat. I mean, dolphins are very intelligent. They're very accommodating. That's not the right word, but they're accustomed to human beings. They work well with human beings, and they were trained for military purposes. The Soviet Union actually trained dolphins as kind of like human torpedoes almost. I don't know if they ever actually used them in warfare. I hope not, but they basically trained them to kind of hover beneath enemy ships with timed explosives strapped to their backs and, you know, to do things like that. There were supposedly two attack dolphins, if you can believe that. But a gentleman named John Lilly, who came up with the sensory deprivation tank.
Right.
Very brilliant guy. I don't know if I want to say eccentric. He was a forward-thinking person. Let's put it that way. He really was the reason why there was a movie called Day of the Dolphins, because it was his research that inspired that line of thought, and probably the line of thought that you remember. He did some serious research about this. He had a lady down in the Virgin Islands in the early 1960s in a laboratory, and they basically he had his lab assistant live with dolphins for a couple of months in an attempt to learn dolphin. As to why we can't talk to them yet, Lily's personal theory was one of his theories was that possibly the dolphins don't want to talk to us.
Why not?
Yeah.
What do we got to say to them other than we're sorry?
Right, right. And I'm not being flippant there.
Or where's the fish? There might be another question they actually might want to talk to us about. But that brings us to underwater cities. And again, I think, like, you know, it just this, if nothing else, for an experimental you know, for reasons of space flight and for, you know, reasons of space mining, where there might be, you know, something to glean off the bottom of the ocean, one would have thought that there would be underwater cities by now. I mean, right. It only made sense. I mean, that one seemed like there'd be a cost, you know, effective reason for having them.
Well, I should note that there are underwater sea hotels. There's one in Florida, and there's I'm going to get the country wrong, but I believe it might be Dubai, where they just built the world's tallest building, and they're also having financial problems.
Right.
But I don't know if they took an analogy to the gold rush too far with making those predictions about underwater cities, because that was the thinking in the 60s, was that, you know, much as we had El Dorado in the western United States with the discovery of gold, once they figured out how to commercially exploit the sea bottom, and there's all kinds of resources there. I mean, there's oil. I think there's a manganese that's easily harvested from the ocean bottom, a few other materials, minerals. I think they thought that the analogy would follow through, you know, with the gold rush. I mean, we would have kind of like old west towns, so to speak, in the ocean bottom. Apparently, they could get what they needed to get from the oceans without going through the developmental expense of building, you know, the highly pressurized underwater cities. But this was a big one. I mean, this was a staple of the World's Fair back in 1964. General Motors had an entire little section of an exhibit dedicated to underwater cities, and it was pretty neat. They showed this underwater suburban house and cutaway. So you saw Dad on the top floor and Mom in the kitchen, the middle floor, and Junior in the bottom. And they had their little sea cars, which are, of course, made by GM, I'm sure. And
right.
It was pretty neat, and it was pretty convincing, too. I mean,
well, convinced me.
Me too. I mean, that was a little before my time, but by the time I came along, I was thinking Ocean City. Sure, I was thinking Aquaman.
You know, but, you know, I mean, I'm going to go to the subtitle of your book here for a second. Again, we're talking with Paul Milo, Your Flying Car Awaits, Robot Butlers, Lunar Vacations, and Other Dead Wrong Predictions of the 20th Century. You know, Robot Butlers is getting close. I mean, I don't know that I would say dead wrong when it comes to Robot Butlers. Lunar Vacations we're a ways away from, but certainly space tourism is at least happening. It may not be ubiquitous, but it is happening.
Right, right. We're talking about a question of scale. Space tourism, yes, you obviously got Branson and Virgin Galactic, and he's unveiling the space plane this year. But the space tourism that was popularly envisioned by the 1960s was mass tourism. I mean, like, going to orbit was going to be like going to Hawaii. Going to the moon was going to be like going to Hawaii. It wasn't going to be a thing where you have to be a plutocrat to get a space on the plane. I mean, it was supposed to be, you know, a salesman from wherever was supposed to be able to take his family or her family to a lunar station or an orbiting station for a 2-week stay. Robot butlers, again, and you're probably right. Dead wrong might be overstating it, but not by much, because what they were talking about back in the 50s, back in the 60s, you know, even up to the mid-1970s, were either, you know, articulated robot, you know, self-ambulating type Jeeves machines.
Right.
Or they were talking about houses that were completely automated. I mean, they woke you up, they made your breakfast, they automatically maintain the ideal climate. And I mean, it was supposed to be a climate system that tapped into your biorhythms to set the ideal temperature.
Right.
Back in the 50s, too, this was an especially funky vision. They thought that Mom would, and it was, of course, it was Mom because it was the 50s, but, you know, Mom would just put in the appropriate punch cards and breakfast, lunch, and dinner would be taken care of. And we're not there yet. You know?
No.
So we have Roombas, but we're still fairly a good distance away from...
No, I'll go along with that. The robots I'm thinking of are really more, again, driven by need in Japan.
Yes.
And this is different, and coming up actually this Saturday on Coast to Coast, I'm going to have Joel Barker on, who's the guy who's most famous for popularizing the term paradigm shift, and he's a futurist and a business writer, and he's going to be on to talk about. We went back to an article in the New York Times Magazine in the year 2000, and they were making predictions about just a quick 10 years. And maybe you've seen this piece at the time, Paul, but they said these are the following inventions are what we will have for sure by the year 2010. This is the New York Times Magazine in the year 2000. So we've got that, Joel and I do. We're going to go over it coming up this Saturday, the things that got close, the things that did happen, and the things that, you know, were like still like what were they smoking kind of a thing of the New York Times. But that's one of those deals is the idea of these robots, because the robots in Japan are being driven by need. There's too many seniors in the sense, I say too many, meaning that there's not enough people to care for them or willing to care for them. And robots become, well, you know, maybe filling in the gaps there. And that, I think that still comes down to most people in the United States, do we really need a butler? How much do you really need a butler? How much do you need a Jeeves? And how much are you willing to pay for having a robot Jeeves?
Excellent point. And it's interesting, too, about the Japanese situation. Part of that is driven by, for whatever reason, the Japanese are just reluctant to admit great masses of immigrants. Instead of letting, you know, tens of thousands of Filipinos come in, I use that because the Philippines exports a lot of their people.
Sure. To other countries, right?
Right.
Saudi Arabia, et cetera.
Right. And the United States. For whatever reason, the Japanese, instead of having Filipinos come and take care of their elderly, and they have probably the oldest population in the world at this point, I guess. They want to build robots to do it. Yeah. I mean, the tricky part of writing a book like this is that in 2 years, you know, my dead wrong prediction could become dead right.
Dead wrong. Exactly.
my dead wrong prediction could be dead wrong.
And that's interesting. It sort of puts you in the same boat as the people that were making predictions in the 50s. And I love that about you. And I love that about this book, that you're pretty open about that. But there are some things that you make a point for that at least we don't experience it on a common level. The idea of, say, weather manipulation. Now, there are many people that argue that weather manipulation is happening. We certainly know of countries that claim the ability to do weather manipulation. China is a good example of this. But the idea of having a real certainty of what the weather is going to be, that's still unavailable to all of us today. It's still kind of a crapshoot.
Right, right. I tried to be careful in how I phrase these things, because strictly speaking, they can dispense fog at airports. They have pretty good success in the United States manipulating snowfall in certain conditions in the western part of the country, especially near the Rockies. There are some people who kind of defend the idea of cloud seeding, and there are some scientists who say it's absolute bunk.
Right.
But when I chose weather control as one of my predictions, because what they envisioned back in the 50s and 60s, like you said, there would be no weather reporters anymore, because it wouldn't be news. It would be the government telling you it's going to rain today, it's going to be cold today, it's going to be hot
right.
today.
Yeah. We've dialed up some storms today because yesterday was too dry, so,
right.
you know, et cetera. Well, here's what I want to do. I see whether you're game for this, Paul. I want to go to the phones coming up. And I'd love for people to talk about, if they haven't seen your book, or they've gone online and they can link up to Paul Milo's book at coasttocoastam.com, for them to talk just openly about the things that they anticipated would be there for them.
Oh, that'd be a lot of fun. That'd be a blast.
And if it's not in your current book, it might be in a sequel.
Yeah.
Okay. And so take some notes here coming up on what folks expected from the 20th century, from the 21st century, what they thought they would have before they died. What are the inventions? What were the conventions? What were the things that were, I mean, as you looked forward into your golden years, you thought you would be doing what? That it doesn't look like it's going to be happening now. We'll give you all the numbers you need, and you too can join in the conversation with Paul Milo. Your flying car awaits, robot butlers, lunar vacations, and other dead wrong predictions of the 20th century, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. What happened to all of the inventions we were supposed to have? What was the invention you were expecting to have by this point in your life that's not here yet? Paul Milo has written a whole book about that. It's way fun. Your Flying Car Awaits, sarcastic title. And would entertain a sequel to this book. How many things were you expecting? What were the inventions that aren't here? Maybe they're in this book. Maybe they're not yet, but they deserve to be talked about. Our disappointments, the broken promises of these modern times. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so we'll get to your calls here in just a second. Paul Milo is a freelance writer whose work appears in BeliefNet, is that right, Paul?
Yes.
And where else will people be familiar with you?
I've written a number of pieces for the now-defunct editor and publisher.
recently defunct E&P,
right.
Isn't it? Yeah,
right,
just like
right.
The last 2 months or something.
And yeah. I hope I'm not a jinx. I did some work for a magazine where I live here in Jersey that also folded. I've also had some work in the Wall Street Journal, the Boston Globe, the Pittsburgh Post Gazette, and a few other publications.
Well, there you go. Your career is heading in the right direction. The future is bright. Your flying car awaits. Let's get to Tom on Coast to Coast AM, west of the Rockies. Hey, Tom, what was the invention that you were counting on as a kid?
I was hoping for the cars you can just get into, tell it where you want to go, and sit back and relax.
Right.
That whole self-driving car thing, but I don't see those around yet.
Well, Paul?
Yeah, I think we're going to see those in 15 years. Inside of my personally, I'll go out on a limb. It's only fair that I make a prediction myself, and that's one of the ones I'll go out on a limb for. I think within 15 years we'll have those. I mentioned those in my book because they have been predicting those since the 30s, so it's reasonable to have expected a self-driving car by now. And they were doing experimentation on this up until the late 1990s. They actually built an automated highway near San Diego in 97. And it worked as advertised. It worked extraordinarily well. Traffic flowed far more smoothly. They were able to accommodate a lot more cars in much less time. But I mentioned collision avoidance technology again, but with collision avoidance technology and GPS technology and the cars that can parallel park by themselves, which you have right now, at least in the high-end models, I think we're gonna get via a number of different ways we're going to get to the self-driving car before I retire.
Charles in Berkeley, California, on Coast to Coast. Charles, what was the invention from your childhood you thought you'd have by now?
Well, I'm almost afraid to say on the air, although it actually does exist. The world's first ever sex robot was just released as an actual product. It's called True Companion. I'm just kidding.
Right. Don't go any further for that. I'll get to your other... But that sex robot, that was a very interesting thing because, I mean, they've had... You know, there has been sex-like... devices. But yeah, this true sex robot.
That's right.
Paul, have you been following this, Paul?
Yeah, and they one of the richer veins from my research were old copies of Omni magazine from the late 70s and early 80s, and Omni was neat. I mean, I actually remember this magazine from when I was a kid, and they kind of covered I'm going to use a very unfortunate verb here. They kind of covered subjects that straddled science and sex.
Right.
Can I squeeze in a thought, though, if I may? Two quick things. First of all, I've actually met Dr. Mueller personally several times. He's the one who's developed the Sky Car, which actually is a self-guiding car, does not require ground controllers. In fact, NASA has a whole highway in the sky system that's already been developed. I should point out for military, actually. And number two, MIT has got the Super Soldier Project. And they've been developing the exoskeleton, which actually is exactly that. It provides superhuman strength. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of these things, which are actually right over the corner. Number three, I'm just a few miles here from Stanford, and I'm very familiar with the DARPA Challenge Project, which actually is an autonomous self-steering vehicle. And they won the prizes here, the last year, I should say. And in that prize, or in that third version of that contest, they actually had cars which would drive themselves through cityscapes, over rough terrain, through tunnels, across bridges. I mean,
sure.
The first time I tried it 3 years ago, 4 years ago, everything failed. So within about 2 years, it went from that to really truly functional vehicles. So, I mean, I think a lot of these things, and I don't want to say your guest is wrong, but he may have missed a few points in the sense that these things are not that far off. They may be a matter of scale, as you said, but these things are not at all impossible. And I think it's just a matter of translating from mostly military development to commercial markets where there's enough of a market interest to justify some kind of, you know, large production process. But it's not the technology that's failed. I just may want to put that point out there if I could.
Well, I appreciate it. It's nice to hear from you again, Charles. But I hated the fact that you interrupted. We were talking about that sex robot. I think that was a very interesting thing because as much as I think all of your other observations are right on, maybe, I don't want to jump over that because I think that there was that the Omni magazine being produced by the same guy that produced Penthouse, right?
Bob Lucioni, right.
Right. And I'm not advocating that people should want them or use them. But that speaks to the larger thing about whether there's a market for something will determine whether or not it actually gets made. And there is a lot of people really like to drive, and they'd rather take the imperfections of driving themselves than being ferried about.
Right.
And DARPA notwithstanding, which I love, and thanks again, Charles, for jumping in. Finish up that thought about the sex robot, because I thought that was interesting. You're talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, you mentioned the demand. I mean, certainly, if the demand is there, it's going to happen. And there's a proven market for virtual sex, you know.
Yeah, but the reasons I think it speaks to that actually speak to the same age of technology we live in. More and more people are feeling disenfranchised from each other. You can live a fairly separate existence. There may be a gap, an ever-widening gap in the ways in which we're acculturated in relationships in this society that prevents some people from being able to be in human relationships, or at least it's too much of a challenge for them to bother with. And I think this is where – I think it's actually a kind of a bad thing for us. Sex robots, the more they're successful, the more it will minimize the need that we have to get outside of our own skin, outside of our own comfort zone, and risk being in relationships with human beings.
You know, this is a bit of an aside, but I mean, that is kind of an interesting symptom of that phenomenon that's described in books like Balling Alone.
Right.
And the whole electronic virtual social networking. I mean, you're starting to wonder if Facebook and Twitter are supplanting face-to-face contact. You know, I mean, there used to be you'd meet people at the ball game or the town picnic or even the tavern, and they're almost becoming dated institutions. Ian, if I could just quickly address a couple of the points the caller made.
Sure, because, Charles in Berkeley. He's a good guy.
Okay. I actually do mention Mueller in my book, and I do note that the technology to build the car is there, and I kind of qualify the flying car a little bit. Just to give the listeners a better flavor of what the book is about, what I do is I take predictions where, and Ian, you mentioned this too, where the thinkers believe that by now the things I talk about would be ubiquitous, not just possible, but all over the place.
Right.
You know, the military exoskeleton, you know, obviously that could very well be working. It's just not available on a mass market basis. That's the kind of predictions I discuss. You know, what the tenor of day-to-day life is really like as opposed to what they thought it would be like. Just wanted to get that out there.
No, I think it's really good, and I think that's why it's an interesting discussion. Going back to the idea of what is good for us and what isn't, I'm reminded of a previous guest on Coast to Coast, Dr. Leonard Sachs, and he talked about how the women of a certain age, of an early age, of an age in their 20s, are asking, where are the men? That we have a lot of grown boys who don't,
yeah,
who spend a lot of time, you know, in video games and with these sort of arrested development 20s that are living in their parents' basement while they're ready to move on and they're not. And I fear what will happen if that sex robot thing becomes more common and affordable is it'll put further strain and almost unpredictable tragedy. Can't quite see how badly it's going to end. in our society if there's a whole generation of people that can, a whole generation of men who can order a robot around like they can order around an avatar on Call of Duty.
Right.
And what's going to happen to their life if they're not willing to get outside of the basement? Don is in Omaha, Nebraska on Coast to Coast for Paul Milo. Don?
Hey, yeah. How you guys doing?
Good. What was the invention you thought you'd have by now at this point in your life?
Oh, a whole bunch of things I'm glad we don't have.
Like what?
Well, I used to watch the Jetsons, and it occurred to me as I was listening to your show this evening that they all lived up in the stratosphere, and I know that the show was supposed to be a comedy, but why did they all live in the stratosphere? What happened to the Earth below? You know, was this some kind of dark humor on Hanna-Barbera's part, you know? Because I never thought about that until just now. The show actually used to kind of creep me out because you'd look out their windows, it was all dark, and then somebody explained to me that's because they live in the stratosphere, and now I'm like, why do they live in the stratosphere? What happened to the good green earth below?
Right, right.
You know, there are a bunch of inventions, and thank you, Don. You mentioned, you think about the Jetsons, they certainly had the butler robot in Rosie.
Hmm.
They were they had flying cars. They had the food that you spoke of, the idea of programming in with a button what kind of food you were going to eat. But the central, you know, kind of dramatic conceit, if you will, of the Jetsons was that human beings don't change. We may have all this stuff, but we still don't change. We're still the same people, no matter how much technology we have at our disposal. You know, that part will never go away. And maybe it informs why there was no Earth left for them to visit.
Right.
Or why they outgrew that. All right, well, then that brings me to X, wildcard line, X from New Earth on Coast to Coast for Paul Milo. Paul, I let you sort out X. Go ahead, X.
Okay. Hi, Ian. Thanks for all the great work. A short question statement and three short statements. Why do you want the thousands of cars traveling over your head? Wouldn't it be better to travel by teleportation and see the beautiful sky? If humanity ever got really liberating inventions, we wouldn't need a government anymore, and the federal government isn't going to allow that because it wants to keep us as our slaves. Our physical bodies and our breath are magical. If we knew how to use them, we could live forever, and we wouldn't need robots at all.
Well, the live forever part's very interesting. Thank you, X. Because the 200-year-old body was something that many of us thought we'd have by now, right, Paul?
Right. There was a lot of very serious work about that. There was a couple of gerontologists thought we'd hit 1,000. And as for teleportation, I'll concede the point that teleportation would do away with the need for flying cars and regular cars and a lot of other stuff. And I didn't touch the teleportation thing in my book too much because I really couldn't, at least for the time period I was looking at, I really didn't find a lot of folks who were betting too heavily on teleportation by now. But man, wouldn't that be neat?
Yeah,
I was a big Star Trek fan when I was a kid, and the transporter's kind of close to teleportation.
It sure is, and yet I also again come down to, I mean, there's lots of things we could say would be neat. It'd be neat if we had the, you know, the Harry Potter version of teleportation, or we had any kind of, but I still think part of us wants to see stuff. I don't know. I mean, to go back to X's point, I think we like to look at stuff, and I don't know that we ever want to get in a place where we really don't we don't experience some form of travel. We might want it accelerated at our pleasure when we, but I don't know that, I mean, I kind of think about that and I just think, I don't know that I want to be teleported. I don't think I have to be somewhere that fast.
Right.
But I know that there'd be applications for it. First time caller line, Sebastian is in Newport Beach, California. One of our last calls on Coast to Coast for Paul Milo. Your flying car awaits. Sebastian?
Hey, and hey, Paul. Thanks for taking my call again. Yeah, I always thought, even since I was a youngster, that we would have places to live and visit, like on the moon, and, you know, have coast-to-coast trains, you know, bullet trains like the Japanese had. I mean, I remember even being told this by NASA astronauts who came to visit our school a number of times. Boy, That's kind of a bit of a disappointment. Although I will say that with the internet, that is probably one of the biggest saving graces I can think of.
Sure.
Although to be intellectually honest about it, isn't it pretty pathetic that we're satisfied with it when we went to the moon in 69 and it took them this long to come up with the internet? Please.
Yeah. You know? Interesting thought about bullet trains. I mean, Vice President Biden's still talking about those trains, right? I mean, that's still a lot of discussion about bullet trains.
And the idea too, and I'm with Sebastian on both the bullet trains and the space exploration, because I was a big astronomy buff when I was a kid. I thought I'd have a job in orbit by now. I mean, if you asked me in 1975. Right. What I'd be doing in 2010, I'd be like, well, I'd be a mechanic on a space station. So I'm with you on that one, Sebastian.
But President Reagan even talked about the suborbital flights, right? I mean, flying from Washington to Tokyo by going up and then letting the Earth rotate and coming down again.
You know, that's interesting. And this has cropped up repeatedly in our discussion. It's the economics that always seem to trip these things up. I mean, we have the Concorde, right? The Concorde was the next logical step before the hypersonic plane. Well, where's the Concorde now? They're not flying them anymore because the economics never worked. I believe the Concorde was never a profitable venture. If it was, it was maybe only profitable for a year or two.
Well, because they had a limitation on seats and weight versus the fuel. I think what's interesting about that is what might be different is if they were able to come up with a suborbital version that you didn't have to worry about you getting to Tokyo. Tokyo came to you.
Yeah, right.
In a way. I mean, you would go up and then
the
it was just
been beneath you.
Yeah, it was just a matter of going up and then coming back down again to a greater degree than the SST. Greg is in Reno. He'll be our last call for Paul Milo on Coast to Coast. Paul, Greg, what was the invention you were thinking you'd have by now?
Well, first of all, let me answer one thing. That question about the Jetsons, why they were above the clouds, that was because they wanted to stay above rain and storm clouds so they could have Henry the butler raise and lower the building whenever they wanted to.
Okay.
He showed that in the first episode.
You mean Henry the super? Yeah, he was the jet, right?
Super.
Okay. Got to be real quick here because we're just about out of time. Greg?
Probably, I was going to say a space station in orbit, and then also that invention from one of the Woody Allen movies. They had that. It was a humorous thing, that orgasmatron.
Sleep. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're getting pretty close to that. I don't know. That one may be a different conversation for a different time. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, everybody, for jumping in. Paul Milo, fun book. Your flying car awaits. Best of luck with this. And let us know what you come up with a part two on that. All right?
Absolutely. And thank you.
Oh, thank you. Have a great night. Well, what a great twofer that was, and thank you to Nicholas Meyer and all the great work being done by the producers to make that one happen. Look forward to having him back on. Again, Joel Barker, in a way, picking up this theme coming up this Saturday night. Futurist Joel Barker will go forward from 2010, but also look back as well to what we thought we would have by now. In the meantime, Deus te amat, and I do too.